Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a talk show bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Today's guest is Dr. Kirkland Hall. Dr. Hall is a 1974 alum and recently retired professor from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. He's a local civil rights activist, a political figure, and a minister. And that's just scratching the surface. Dr. Hall, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I certainly appreciate being here.
If you don't mind me asking, when and where were you born?
I was born in a little community called Oaksville, Maryland. That's 5 miles east of Prestonstown.
What was it like for you growing up in Somerset County?
Well, it was an experience that I will never forget. My family was quite poor. At a young age, we did a lot of work in the fields, picking tomatoes, string beans, strawberries, and the like. But I must say my education at the local high school was quite excellent. I must say that. But it was just tough. I grew up going Jim Crow. I knew what it was to go to a black high school, ride on all-black school bus, sit in the balcony at the movie theaters, going to the back doors of restaurants, not being able to drink out of certain water fountains. So I went through quite a bit in my youth.
Did you ever attend integrated schools when you were a youngster?
No, I did not. Basically, all the schools I attended were all black.
Did you have much interaction with young people who weren't black or, you know, anybody outside of the black community when you were growing up?
Well, when I worked in the fields, a lot of the farmers had children my age, so I had a chance to talk with them and play on occasion when there was a break. But the majority of the time, we were basically integrated.
Did that have any impact on you in terms of making you feel as though you were different or you were less than, or were you so young that you really didn't pay any mind to the fact that you couldn't, you know, interact with white kids and white people?
But one thing, I was blessed. My father, even though he had a sixth grade education, he had a vision. And he always told us, regardless of where we are, a condition you're living in, it doesn't have to be that way. And all we need to do is get education, work hard, and we'll be a success. And he was true.
In December 2018, you retired from UMES. To say that you have had a long relationship with the school would be an understatement. So talk about your history with UMES. It spans several decades.
Well, one thing I can say is that UMES was very good to me. I learned a lot. I achieved a lot. But one of the most important things is I was in the first class, upper bound class, in 1966. So I had an idea of what it was to be on the UMES campus. I met a lot of talented athletes, had some great teachers, and honestly, they prepared me for what was to come. And then as an instructor there for a number of years, some of the experiences I had, coaching different sports, meeting people from all over the world, it was a tremendous experience and one I will never forget.
Right, and you talked about the athletics. So you were a pretty good athlete in your day. Talk a little bit about your success on the playing field and then also how you, I guess, used that to your advantage when you came to UMES as a student first and then later in a more professional manner.
As I said, at Somerset, although the school was in existence for a short period of time, you know, I would say we had some of the best teachers in the world, and they prepared us for almost any obstacle that we would face in our adulthood, from Esquire Club, knowing how to dress, knowing how to treat people with respect and dignity, to the French Club, teaching French, informing us that it was best to learn a second language. And then the athletic program, we had some of the greatest coaches. In my 4 years as an athlete, we won 2 state championships in basketball and 2 runner-up championships. In baseball, we had 2 championships. Cross country, we had 3 championships. So we knew what it was to win. We knew what it was to work hard, and we developed those lasting friendships during high school. Then as I moved to UMBS, or Maryland State at the time, a number of people from my high school and people from the community that I played against, you know, came to UMBS or Maryland State. And we renewed those friendships. I was blessed to play baseball for 4 years, basketball for 3 years. And again, I had a chance to meet so many people. I can't express that enough. But again, from coaching, 33 years, from traveling, again, meeting people. You know, everywhere I go, I see somebody I used to know, I used to play against. And that what makes life that enjoyable. And they say, they haven't forgotten me. And that's a good thing.
And then you also served as the, were you the athletic administrator at one point at the university?
I was director of athletics for 5 years. And during that stint as a coach prior to becoming athletic director, I was a head coach in 2 sports. I taught and I ran a summer youth program. And what I did, I introduced a proposal to the president and the executive vice president at that time that if we're going to compete athletically, coaches should not have to teach and coach at the same time. So I wrote a proposal. It was accepted by the Board of Regents. And even today, coaches are not teachers. The only thing they do is coach. And that's all they have to do.
I know UMBS had a really great tradition in terms of football at one point. Were you a student or coach at all during those years when they had the football team?
Well, during my era, the football team was, let me say, was not as strong as it was prior to. And what happened, integration impacted our athletic program. Before then, when Maryland State, or UMBS, got some of the best athletes in the country. I mean, that's baseball, basketball, and football, and track. But because of integration, that impacted UMBS, a small school in a small town. We didn't have much to draw people from. Our tradition was diminishing very rapidly. And thus, I applaud the coaches that we had because they did the best they could. But we were just unable to bring those outstanding athletes in. But prior to those years, the football program, you know, it could match any school in the country.
Now, you were at UMBS a total of how many years, Coach?
Well, to be honest with you, 49 of my 68 years were spent on the UMBS campus. Wow. But I taught 42 years total, and again, I coached 33 years.
So in your opinion, how much has the university evolved, both academically as well as athletically, over that long time span?
Yeah, it's amazing. And I applaud the presidents and active administrators for what they did at the school. I look at aviation science. I look at School of Allied Health, you know, which has pharmacy. I hear physician assistant is coming back for exercise science program, rehabilitation program. The school opened up avenues for a number of kids where they would not have had those opportunities if they didn't move forward. The hospitality program, which offered kids opportunity to be entrepreneurs. And so the school, when I was there were very few majors. Your math, your science, your physical education, your business, home economics, and a few others. But now, academically, the school has opportunities for anyone who wants to better themselves professionally. And then I look at the buildings. And I was there, you might have 10 buildings on campus when I first started there. Now the school is growing very rapidly, and another building is getting ready to come up in a couple of years. So aesthetic-wise, it's a beautiful campus. And I think we're one of the best-kept secrets in the country.
What's been the biggest adjustment for you since you retired?
I stayed retired 16 days. I retired December 31st, 2018. And after 16 days, I received a phone call from the public schools say they need some teachers at Washington High School and was I available. And I agreed after 2 days. And I told them I'll be available 2 days a week. And that's the best I can do. I have not missed but 2 days since the third week of January. I've been on the Washington High School campus. teaching history and social studies. So, and I'm happy, and I enjoy what I do. I've always enjoyed teaching, and sometimes it's good to change scenery. Working at UMS all those years, you know, it says sometimes a prophet is without honor in his own country. And since I've been at Washington High, while a lot of kids don't know me, I'm telling you, I'm just enjoying myself each and every day, just watching the kids grow from my first day and to where they are now.
Being at that lower level, do you see certain things that, I guess, kind of give you some insight as to why the students are the way they are by the time they get to college as freshmen?
In Somerset and at Washington, we have some very talented kids. But one thing that's lacking, we need to let them know what to expect if they go to college, if they go into business, if they go to trade school. And I believe we're going to have to do a better job preparing those kids for the real world. Also, at this stage, they need to learn responsibility. They need to learn respect and understand that everything they do now goes on the record. And this may hinder them later in life, but if this is not reinforced each and every day, you know, some of our kids will be lost by the time they become adults.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UMES 30. Today's guest is Dr. Kirkland Hall, also known as Coach Hall. He's a retired UMES professor and a respected community activist here in the area. In 1933, a tragic event happened not too far from the UMES campus, which stained the national image of Princess Anne. The event involved a young black man named George Armwood. So, Dr. Hall, you wrote your dissertation on this event. Who was George Armwood, and what attracted you to his story?
Well, I was amazed that I've lived in Somerset County the majority of my life, and I heard nothing about this particular incident until I read a book by Dr. John Winterston, a former professor at UMES, a history professor, and he wrote a book called Maryland Eastern Shore. And I don't know what prompted me to pick it up, but I bought the book, I started reading it, and lo and behold, it came up about George Armwood. And because of my interest, I decided to do some research to learn more about it. I talked to my relatives, who never mentioned it during my childhood. But as I started reading, I got more interested in it. And then when I enrolled in graduate school, I had to think of a project. And I could not think of anything better than that George Armwood story and how it impacted Somerset County then and how it impacts Somerset County even today.
And what actually did happen with the George Armwood story?
Well, if you read accounts by a number of authors, some said he tried to rape an elderly white woman in Princess Anne after she left the post office. Some said he tried to rob her after she left the post office, because knowing she always carried around a great deal of money. No one really know. But the answer, but we do know they did not receive a trial. He was lynched in Princess Anne. He was burned in Princess Anne. He was drugged down the street in Princess Anne. His burnt body was left at Hamer's Hardware Store in Princess Anne. So we know that as a fact. But whether or not he committed a crime, we will never know. But, and that's what intrigued me about the mystery, so that, you know, that's why I wrote my dissertation, so that people would know that this incident did happen in Princess Anne in 1933.
During this time period, you have a number of lynchings happening throughout the United States South. In fact, they say you had about over 5,000 or close to 5,000 lynchings that would occur after the Civil War, really up through the 1950s, but you had the George Armwood lynching happening here. And again, a lot of times the people who were lynched tended to be African-American males, and they would be lynched for a number of reasons. Sometimes they were accused of raping a white woman. Sometimes it was assaulting a white woman. Sometimes it was just being out of place, you know, acting too confidently around whites. And some of them, you know, may have been guilty of crimes, and then others weren't. And then in a lot of times, the community kidnapped the body from the jail, and then the lynching itself would be a big public spectacle. And you could see pictures of this online where you'll see folks dressed up as though they just left church. You may see little kids there, couples smiling, and then you'll have these black bodies hanging from the poplar tree as Billie Holiday and Nina Simone sang the famous song Strange Fruit. And then another thing with this is people would take photographs of the bodies of the victims, and they would sell those, and those would become souvenirs, and they may even cut off pieces of the victim's limbs and keep that as well as a souvenir. So this was a really, really bad time in American history. And now, Coach Hall, I know you actually have, at some point, you had an event where you brought in family members of Armwood and then family members of the accusers, and you brought them together. Can you just talk briefly about why you did that and how it turned out?
Well, first of all, I think in order for any incident, a tragic event, to heal, and it must be some understanding. And one of the things, it's always good when there's a problem for families to talk it over, because it was not them or that group who committed this atrocity. It was those folk in 1933. But everyone told me that it was not be successful. I don't know why you're trying to do it. You're not going to get anybody there. But because of the interest, had a member from the Orwood family showed up, and three relatives from the elderly white lady's family. I'm sorry, six authors who wrote books on the incident, and they all attended the event, so it went so well. As a matter of fact, we had a luncheon after that, and I found out that I was related to the Armwood family by my uncle, who was about 90 years old when I interviewed him, and he told me that, you know, they're your relatives. So right now we're doing an extensive search to our family tree to find out where he falls in and if I'm his relative. But I did find the listings of a great people who died in my community, Oaksville, and there were two Armwood, John Armwood and Void Armwood, were buried in my family cemetery. And so that gives a little assurance that there were some ties with Oaksville. And now we'll continue doing our search to see if we are related in some fashion. And when the fact that I was related to them, that motivated me even more to do more research on that incident. But so we're still working on that particular avenue. But ever since I've done research, people have called, and I've been doing speaking engagements, and just to educate the public that it happened, hopefully get some type of reconciliation. And we got to find out the truth. When I say truth, we can't find out whether or not he actually committed that act or not. But truth, so that we could be live with ourselves, that it did happen, and maybe we'll get some healing from there.
You know, Governor Larry Hogan recently signed a bill into law that's going to create a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, similar to what you had in South Africa following the end of apartheid. But this commission here is going to study all of the lynchings that occurred in Maryland. Do you think this commission can be effective, and what do you want to see it accomplish?
Well, first, I'm happy to see that it came into fruition, because we have been working on that particular venue for years. Shirley Field, who came down to our campus, and during the summit that we had on the Armwood lynching, as a matter of fact, she has started and put together a portfolio of all the communities in the country that have done the same thing. And she proposed that we try to do the same thing for Somerset County, Wacomico County, or wherever it happened on the Lower Shore. And I'm quite sure she has influence in this. And I spoke in Baltimore in October of last year at the Reginald Lewis Museum, talking about this same thing with other people who had an interest in it. And they said they're going to make that proposal. It was passed. I'm happy that it's done, but we're waiting to see what's going to happen in the end.
Can you briefly say something about your work with the NAACP and also local politics here on the Eastern Shore?
You know, sadly, everything we did in the NAACP, in order to make changes in our community, we had to go to court. We had to go to court to get an injunction for blacks to volunteer for the President Volunteer Fire Department. We won. In order to get people, per county commissioner, president and town commissioners, Crisfield city commissioners, we had to go to court to get those districts. We had to go to court to let them know that if a person is not not living in Prince Anne or Somerset County, they cannot vote in Prince Anne or Somerset County because they're landowners. So it went to court, and we won that. So basically everything that we have done, we've had to go to court in order to win. And I think, again, it's because, and excuse me when I want to say this, I don't like to say anything disparaging about anybody, but it seems like throughout the years, the white population in our community always wanted to be in charge, always wanted to be in control, but not understanding that black education, black entrepreneurship, and now it's the time to get equal representation, especially when a county is close to being 50-50 as far as population is concerned. So everybody should have a say in what goes on, as opposed as you have it in our national government, all basically makes a white man or making a decision for the entire country. And we want to make sure that it did not happen in Somerset County and that it's not going to continue.
Are you happy with the progress that Somerset County's made in terms of race relations?
We've made some, and I was happy at a few, but we made some progress. But I think there's a lot more work needs to be done. So we got to be vigilant in what we do.
And you ran for elective office. Is that correct?
I ran for office for the House of Delegates, but I was unsuccessful in that attempt.
Do you see yourself running again in the future?
I've had so many people ask me would I run again. I told them I do not know, but if I decide to run, I'll certainly let you know.
Did you start the NAACP chapter at UMES, or were you just an advisor to the chapter?
I have been involved with the NAACP really when I was a student, and when I returned, I had another advisor. That person left, and I just happened to be available, and I decided to run for a participate advisor for that chapter.
In the past, you've talked to some of my classes, and you've shared your experiences with the students. What do you think about this current generation's role in participation in terms of the civil rights movement? Obviously, we have Black Lives Matter starting a few years ago, and you know there was definitely a lot of involvement from the students on campus during that time period. But just in general, what do you think about this current generation? Do you think they're as active socially and politically as they should be? What's your opinion on that?
All young people today, very few of them know the history. But the kids, they need to study what has happened, learn the history, and understand we still have not made it yet. We still have a number of obstacles that's in our way. And in order for our black community to have the opportunity, we just got to keep working. We got to get involved and understand what's coming down the pike. And instead of sitting back, not attending Board of Education meetings, or not attending President County meetings, or not attending Somerset County meetings, and our students, again, they're going to practice what their parents do. And as parents, we don't set example for our young people, then they are going to be left behind. If we ask them about different things that are happening, Brown versus Board of Education just celebrated an anniversary. If we ask them what happened, they don't know. And so we've got to keep teaching. We've got to encourage them to take history classes. We've got to encourage our adults to educate themselves more so that we can share it with our young people. We've got to have organizations of leaders. We got to teach them how to be leaders and not to be followers all their life. Until we get that trend going back again, we're going to constantly stay in trouble.
And what about our white brothers and sisters and just anybody who's outside of the African-American community?
The NAACP was founded by whites. A number of organizations were founded by whites who had an interest in issues and problems in the African-American community. But now it's time for us to step up, as W.E.B. Du Bois mentioned on numerous occasions, that we've got to educate ourselves. Where is that talented 10 that he always talked about? So we've got to go back and revisit those days and so we can move forward.
Coach, finally, in closing, why should anyone consider sending their children, or if they're an adult themselves or a teenager about to graduate in June, why should they consider sending that young person, or why should they even fill out an application themselves to attend the University of Maryland Eastern Shore for either undergraduate study or graduate study, or if they're a student athlete, you know, why should they want to come here and play sports here?
Well, if I was going to tell any parent to me, and of course I might be biased, But again, UMES had some and still have some of the best teachers in the world. And I always told my daughter, who's now a medical doctor in Nashville, Tennessee, it's not where you go to school, it's what you do there. We have the same books. Now, we may not have the same equipment or all the supplies, but we have the same textbooks, some of the same education materials that they have at any other school. If you want to come to a setting where students will have opportunity to study, we'll have a lot of things to distract them as they go through the academic years at the university. I don't know any better place. And again, there are a number of opportunities that they can get. So I'd rather be a big fish in a small pond than a small fish in a big pond. And so that's the way I see it. And I felt because of the UMES, I had so many opportunities. And because of the opportunities, I had teachers that who care. That class with 30 students or 25 students with a professor, you can get much more out of that than opposed to being in a class with 300 and 400 when I went to Ohio State. The teacher never knew my name, and I felt I was just there. But at UMES, you can work hard and you can be successful.
Dr. Hall, thank you again for joining me. It's been a pleasure talking with you this morning.
Thank you so much. I certainly appreciate your time and appreciate you thinking of me to participate in this interview. Thank you so much.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. Since it's graduation season, I will reflect on two stories that caught my attention. Elizabeth Barker Johnson was a private first class in the U.S. Army during World War II as a member of the 688th Regiment, the only all-female, all-African-American regiment that was stationed overseas during the war. After the war, she enrolled at what is now Winston-Salem State University in North Carolina, formerly Winston-Salem Teachers College, becoming the first female to enroll on the GI Bill. Ms. Johnson earned a degree in education in August of 1949. However, because she was already working full-time as a teacher, she did not get to participate in her graduation and walk across the stage. Instead, she received her degree in the mail. Recently, on her 99th birthday, she received surprise news that she was invited to walk at the upcoming 2019 Winston-Salem State University commencement ceremony. She was recognized on stage with an honorary degree in special education. The other story that caught my attention is about Brittany Holly, who earned a degree in occupational therapy at New York's Clarkson University. Brittany received her diploma on stage with her golden retriever, Griffin, who received his own honorary degree. Holly uses a wheelchair, and Griffith is her service dog. The pair attended all the same classes, lectures, faculty appointments, group study sessions, social activities, research projects, and clinical experiences, fully making Griffin an equal member of the Clarkson Golden Knights family, and that's according to the university's official statement. So that, you know, as a dog lover, that story really touched my heart. So I want to give a special congratulations to these recent graduates, Mrs. Johnson, Brittany Holly, and her dog, Griffin. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again for our guests today. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and other forms of social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.
UMES 30 is produced in the studios of 91.3 WESM, located on the campus of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.